I just don't think there is a one size fits all approach, or, in really, very simple terms, any possibility of just somehow becoming the embodiment of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, or what's said to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. We can only be inspired by those things to find some modern, analog, something that's connected to it. It's similar, but it's not the same thing. Because Patanjali's message was clear: go to the cave and don't come back. Effectively, sit down and shut up was my brother's attempt to summarize the Yoga Sutra, and I think he's onto something.
Welcome to a Curious Yogi podcast. I'm your host, Bobby, joined by living masters and awakening friends. We're here to illuminate your practice as we explore what it means to walk the yogi's path, to unfold peace from within, and to live the vision of oneness. I'm so delighted you're here. Now let's get curious. Welcome back to another episode of Curious Yogi. I'm so happy that you're here and that I'm here and that I get to share yet another illuminating, educating, inspiring yoga talk with you. I had so much fun recording this episode and I learned so much listening to it again. So I know you're going to take so much for your practice. This week's guest is the one and only, one of a kind, really, really, Daniel Simpson. Daniel makes yoga philosophy accessible and fun, as you will hear in this episode. He's the author of The Truth of Yoga, an engaging guide to the main yogic texts and the history of practice, which I'm just finishing now, and it is so, so good. If you're a yoga practitioner or a quote-unquote yoga nerd, go buy this book. It's such a good resource. Daniel also hosts the Ancient Futures podcast, exploring how timeless wisdom shapes modern life. Daniel teaches courses at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, on yoga teacher trainings around the world, and via his website, truthofyoga.com. He has an MA in yoga studies from SOAS, the University of London, and a wide range of practical experience. In a previous incarnation, he was a foreign correspondent working for Reuters and the New York Times. So he's lived, he's experienced, he's studied, and he really speaks the yoga knowledge with so much humility and kindness and clarity and joy. So I just totally loved this conversation. And he does speak a bit at the end of the episode about his upcoming year-long immersion, The Path of Knowledge. So stay right till the end. Listen to him giving the overview of that year-long course. Honestly, it seems amazing. So go check Daniel out, truthofyoga.com, The Truth of Yoga on Instagram. And hey, enjoy this conversation. And don't forget, you can always, always join us on the first Sunday of every month for a very casual study group discussion, meditation on sadhana, on satsang, on all of this yoga stuff. So find us at patreon.com/acuriousyogipodcast. And anything else, hit me up. I love to talk yoga. So big hugs to all and enjoy the episode. So I'll just start off. Welcoming you. Yes. So welcome so much, Daniel, to A Curious Yogi podcast.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, Bobby. It's a pleasure.
It's, it's just great. Like I was just saying, to be able to spend some time with you when we had the chance to meet you at Neusen Festival in the summer. It was so awesome hearing your talks and just meeting you and like appreciating. Also, I've been listening to a couple of your podcasts also and appreciating the, you're a scholar, you're a philosopher, it seems. I don't know if you would identify as those, but, you have so much knowledge about yoga and yet you're so down to earth, so approachable, and you do make the teachings so fun and accessible because that's kind of in your nature. So I just felt such an attraction to you and your teachings in that way this summer when we met. So it's super nice to just pick your brain a little bit in the next 60 minutes.
Oh, thank you, Bobby. That's such a generous introduction. I'm touched. Thank you.
Yes, it's gonna be great. And I definitely feel like I want to dive right into the vast and confusing world of yoga philosophy for all the curious yogis listening, because the people that are listening to this podcast are definitely people that are ready and seeking something beyond, we know, just the more superficial teachings of yoga, which are more mainstream. But I think to start off, it would be great for those listeners to hear a little bit about your story, your journey. Like, how did you go from foreign correspondent to student, teacher, philosopher, scholar of yoga? Like, how, if you could put your journey into some Cole's notes for us.
Sure. I think the honest answer is I took a lot of wrong turns, and I took so many wrong turns that I found myself on the right path. I kind of went round in circles for a little while. I mean, the very, very short version of the story is I worked for an American newspaper, the New York Times, that was promoting the invasion of Iraq in 2003. I quit my job. I tried to run a music festival in the former Yugoslavia. It happened, but all the money vanished and I kind of went off the rails, took too many drugs, and wound up very confused and unemployed. And somebody suggested, "Have you thought about yoga?" And as it happened, yes, I had, because part of the reason I ended up in that whole, drama in the first place was as a result of a couple of trips to India, where I'd spent time hanging out with traditional yogis, and particularly a trip in 2001 to the Kumbh Mela, where I got it into my head that there was some connection, I suppose, between getting high and plugging oneself into the ultimate cosmic matrix that would, I guess, transform all of this war energy that was around in early 2003 into a peace festival. That was the idea of what we were trying to organize. And because it was staged at the meeting point of two rivers, like the Kumbh Mela in Allahabad or Prayag, I had some crazy idea that I was, channeling cosmic ley lines and somehow all the forces would be aligned behind me and it would just be wonderfully effective. And, millions of young people across Europe would suddenly converge on the Balkans for the third summer of love. But it didn't quite happen that way, unfortunately. So, yeah, I'd been to India. I'd been exposed to yoga loosely, but I didn't really understand very much. I'd tried interviewing people about yoga. I was going to make a documentary at the Kumbh Mela, but, I guess I was more interested in hanging out and smoking chillums than I was in actually putting it together. So I've had these mini discs of recordings sitting around in a box for the last 20 odd years, and I recently dug a few out. And it was interesting to hear, the sincerity of my inquiry, I suppose, at that time, but also, quite striking the amount of confusion that was clearly there in my own mind. So I wanted answers. I'd gone to India, definitely as a curious person. I wouldn't have called myself in any way a yogi. I didn't really know what yoga was, but I'd bought some books about yoga. I'd tried to teach myself to meditate, and I went to a few classes on that trip. And somehow it was, I don't know, being in the mountains in northern India, up in the Kullu Valley, and then going up beyond into Zanskar and Ladakh. Just something about being up in the mountains on top of the world brought a certain sense of clarity to everything. And I had this, I guess, vaguely formed idea that there was more I needed to learn and I didn't know where to start. So I guess I put that on hold because I had a very busy and demanding job. And then once I quit it, that's when, I got a bit more serious. But I started, like so many other people, just, doing physical yoga because it made me feel better and stopped me smoking weed all day. And, in the end, I got curious again enough to go and spend more time in India, really just trying to, look a little bit further beyond the physical and to try and understand where yoga had come from. But all of that got confusing as well because there are so many different answers, so many different ways one can look at this very big picture of yoga. So I ended up back at university a little over 10 years ago now to do a master's degree, trying to, I guess, give myself some sort of a framework to hang everything else off. Things I'd experienced through my own practice, things I'd heard about, things I'd read about, things I didn't really understand but thought I should know more about. And as a result of all of that, I started teaching. I was teaching physical yoga, but I started teaching the philosophy of yoga. And then, in response to all the questions people would ask, I ended up writing a book that tied together what I thought was sort of the most important, I guess, strands of information that the academic world had been pulling together over the last generation or so, helping us to understand a little bit better how yoga has evolved over the centuries, because it's not always been the same thing. And what we're familiar with in the Western world is a relatively recent thing, and it's helpful to see how that happened and also what was there before, and to see how much of what was there before we can still bring alive in our own, as it may be, very physical yoga practice. There's still many ways to find those connections. So all of that brought me to where I am now, talking about these things, mainly to yoga teachers or fellow yoga nerds, but also through trying to keep things, fairly accessible, anyone who's curious, really. So yeah, I would certainly call myself curious in both senses of the word. So hopefully that keeps things grounded.
Wow, beautiful. I think it's like really interesting when you were speaking just about like being even hearing yourself back in those interviews, like the sense of confusion that's there and how that's kind of the time immemorial mind that yoga meets is that confused mind. It just made me think of Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. It's like this confused person. And I also can relate to coming to yoga as someone so confused. And almost the confusion becomes so unbearable that the seeker kind of steps into yoga and then ultimately finds clarity and ultimately more confusion. And then kind of also how it makes me kind of not feel better, but it is kind of like a, even you, someone that's studied in a scholarly, scholastic, like very profound, like you're a professor of yoga philosophy, and you
Oh, I
said
wouldn't go that
that.
far, but
But you're on that track, you're in that world, and that there is still so much to unpack. It's like unpack, even reading your book, I'm getting so many answers, and also so many more. With more answers comes more questions, and it's like, is this just the continual unfolding of yoga? It's really it is feels like a journey. Like we're kind of exploring such a vast space of yoga philosophy. And I have a couple more questions. One, I want to
Sure.
ask you, like, in your personal discovery and your personal exploration in yoga, obviously you are exploring the philosophical side, and I'm wondering, what is your personal practice? Do you have a daily practice? Is it still the asana? Do you meditate? Like, what does that look like for you on a personal level?
It really varies, to be honest. When I've got the time and the space and I'm not overworked and overstressed, I find, a lot of, I guess, calling arising in me to, give time and space to yoga practice. When I'm very busy, I try to do some maintenance level, amount, which these days is less and less asana focused, I have to be honest. My body doesn't work the way that it used to. I turned 50 this year. I'm starting to feel, creaky at the joints. I've got arthritis. I can't make all the shapes, and I find it hard to sit. So that really affected my ability to meditate as well. So this year's journey for me has been about finding enough comfort and perhaps also enough humility to be able to engage in those practices again in the way that works for me, particularly pranayama and meditation. Because not being able to sit in the way that I was used to for a long period, cross-legged or, all bound up like a pretzel, I was kind of feeling I couldn't practice anymore. And embracing the fact that I can sit in a chair, for example, or that, there are other ways to sit, or I could get a load of props and kneel up on them, makes it, possible again. But that's involved, as I say, letting go of a lot of my ideas of what practice meant. Because it really did used to mean for me, at least 90 minutes, perhaps 2 hours of quite grueling physical rigor every morning. I practiced for, quite a while, almost 10 years, daily Ashtanga style practice, with a fixed sequence and always trying to, go further as they encourage you. Before that, I was heavily into the Iyengar approach to yoga, and met Mr. Iyengar a couple of times, and took that very seriously as well. And so, in those cases, I spent there was a time when I was hanging out in Rishikesh doing 7 hours of asana a day. And I think I thought that somehow, if I magically got everything into the right shape, something would transform within me. And certainly, it had some cleansing effect on my system, without a doubt, and settled my mind and gave me a way in. But over the years, I've become more and more aware that this is just something else to do. It doesn't necessarily actually change anything. It's how we relate to what we're doing, and it's how I relate to my workload, or the conversations I'm having, or just being present with myself. And that's actually a lot harder than making all the shapes. Sometimes, if you've got a body that can do all of that, it's very easy to think, oh, I'm getting very good at my yoga now just because, I'm contorting a lot. And I don't think that necessarily has anything to do with yoga. It can have, but certainly historically, there was none of that in, there's none of that in the Bhagavad Gita, for example. So the more interesting question to me has become, what is a steady mind? What stops it from being steady? And what things can I cultivate in how I live that will support the development of that steadiness, so that even when everything is very unsteady, there is still some centeredness within my ability to face it, rather than freaking out, getting triggered, losing it completely, which I do from time to time. I'm a human being. I'm definitely not enlightened. So in answer to your previous observation, I think, the whole point, in a way, is to ask questions, as I was just illustrating there, through those sorts of approaches to steadiness in the mind. If we're not asking questions, we've kind of given up the inquiry. And yoga really is an inquiry into who we are, how we work, how we relate to the bigger picture. And if we've got an answer that satisfies us for all time, then congratulations. The end of the journey has been reached. But I don't think I ever met anyone who'd given up asking questions. They might have some very good provisional answers, but they're still exploring because things are still arising, and they're needing to be contemplated and moved through. And so I think it's a moment to moment thing, and actually there is no getting there, and that's almost the beauty of it. The getting there is the acceptance of not getting there, the ultimate letting go of the need to get anywhere. Because certainly, this vehicle in which we're having this conversation, this body that we're both inhabiting, is certainly not going to carry on forever. And that's really where yoga philosophy comes into it. What do we do in relation to that fact, the inescapable reality of death? No amount of yoga practice, no matter what the texts say about immortality, is going to stop this body from falling to pieces. And so, what can we do? Make peace with that fact. What can we do to make the most of being alive while we are alive, and to live in a way that is skillful and wise? And again, we'll fail, but at least we're trying. And then that's I think where the questions come in. What does that mean? How are we going to do that? Why are we even prioritizing these things? Why not just get really rich and live in a castle and have servants? And I mean, the simple answer being, that doesn't necessarily lead to the stability we're looking for. We're looking for something that, is, I guess, not dependent on material circumstances. That's the kind of stability that texts like the Gita are talking about, that there is some way within ourselves of finding that stability, even if there's nothing in the way of material possessions, even if, we're about to get shot by a firing squad. And there are other people who've come at this from a completely non-yogic perspective. I think one author in the 20th century who really stands out for me in that way is Viktor Frankl, who was in concentration camp, talked about, in this book titled Man's Search for Meaning. That was the one freedom that couldn't be taken away from him, this possibility of, navigating the inner landscape to, find some inner sanctum, where things were okay despite the absolute not okayness of everything outside. And so, yeah, I guess that's where yoga is pointing towards. And from that place, we can act. We can do all sorts of things. We can do all the things, in a way, but maybe many of the things will no longer seem quite so relevant anymore, and we'll be content with less.
I love that, like a reminder about the importance of the continual questioning and the inquiry into all the aspects of our inner world and the way we perceive the outer world as well, to just keep questioning and we keep inquiring. And when I was thinking about this conversation, like, what is yoga? I was wondering if it's okay if I read a few sentences
Sure,
from the
yeah, go
little
for it.
section in the book. The section is titled, What is Yoga? And yeah, I'm just gonna read it and we'll jump off from there. So you say here, yoga is sometimes described as a science, but its effects are not easily measured. Since practice consists of experiments on oneself, its results are subjective and broader conclusions are hard to establish. What works for one person affects others differently. This is part of the reason there are so many methods. For example, texts say the yogic state can be attained by effort, hatha yoga, dispassionate action, karma yoga, or devotion, bhakti yoga. Apart from their shared objectives, each of these disciplines has one thing in common: they have to be practiced. Words can only spark a quest for direct knowledge. Traditional practitioners can therefore be wary of yoga philosophy, preferring instead to embody what it signifies. This is all very well, but few of us today share the same basic aims as ancient yogis who strove for freedom and from rebirth. Most of us are trying to find peace in response to life's challenges or exploring what gets in the way of feeling whole. So I just love that. And that really comes back to that point of questioning into the quest for that knowledge. But it brings me to my question of yoga philosophy as something objective or as something as ultimate truth beyond the bounds of pairs of opposites and beyond language. You know, it's like this dichotomy when we're exploring yoga, and I feel this in my own exploration of yoga. For the past 20 years, I've been practicing yoga and constantly f as if flipping between these two ideas of how to apply the philosophy as something objective, because I'm a person with ideas and thoughts and beliefs and conditions, and yet there's a fundamental truth in the yogic teachings. So shed some light on that, Daniel.
Well, I think you summed it up yourself very well. You know, we're all approaching it from a subjective position. It's, you know, something that I, as an individual, am trying to engage with to see beyond the problem that I generate by being an individual. That's really what yoga is pointing towards, the possibility of an impersonal approach to everything that's experienced. Yeah, the idea that things are unfolding through the mind and the body, and that there's no need to identify with them. And yeah, at the same time, although that can be described in a way that does sound quite objective, how does one actually engage with that? It has to be done through an individual mind and body. That's where we all are. And we've all got slightly different conditioning and slightly different obstacles to that, slightly different inclinations, slightly different objectives as well. Not everybody is looking to do that. In fact, you know, the vast majority of people practicing yoga are just, as I sort of alluded to there, trying to get more comfortable in some way. And that's okay. But traditional yoga texts were really trying to say you've got to get out of your comfort zone, and getting too comfortably, you know, attached to an idea of who you are and an identification with particular needs and wants, you know, is the actual problem that you're supposed to be addressing. And so somehow there has to be, I guess, in order to embody all of that, a move beyond this individualized subjective perspective on how to get more comfortable. But that is still the way to begin it. We can't get away from that. And I think, tempting as it is to assume, firstly, that the state of yoga is, I mean, all texts are often talking about something related to being eternal or unchanging or timeless or a state beyond time and space. That's really what immortality is talking about. It's just not conditioned by, the coming and going of things that, created and then eventually decay. Because often that's just referring to just presence, consciousness, being, something that just is. That's what the earliest text that talks about yoga, the Katha Upanishad, says. Asti, it is, it is. That's all you can say about this ultimate state. And so, yeah, it has to just be embodied in that sense. But guidance is needed on how to get there. And, all yoga texts do seem to suggest that you need some teaching. But the teaching can only point to something that has to be, embodied and then somehow transcended through an experience that goes beyond experiencing. It just is. And so whatever language is used is in any case just a stepping stone. And because of our different makeups, we'll have different ways in. So I think it's very hard to, come up with some sort of universal blueprint and say, this is the one true yoga. Firstly, there isn't one because there have been so many different manifestations of yoga over the centuries that, there are massive contradictions at times between them. Secondly, that there's this simple step-by-step program of how to embody what that one true yoga is all about. And having just said all that, one can take that too far. One can get too scholarly and analytical and say, oh, well, there's all these distinctions and everybody's got their own way of looking at stuff and things are therefore a bit contradictory and it's impossible to generalize. And the ultimate conclusion of that is there's no such thing as yoga, would be one alternative. The other thing would be there is no way to define yoga because all of these competing definitions, clash with one another. And I don't think either of those two approaches are very helpful because there is a third way of looking at it all, which is to come back to basics and sort of say, well, there are some common threads and there are some, basic sort of principles, I think, that underpin most yoga frameworks to a certain extent. Not all, and there are always exceptions, but we can, through, I guess, a bit better understanding of how traditional systems have worked and the ways in which traditional texts have put their teachings together, almost build our own framework. Think about, where are we? What's going on for us? And how do these particular combinations of practices and philosophies, land in us? And construct for ourselves almost a 21st century yoga philosophy that's addressing modern needs in accordance with some of these timeless principles. I mean, that's what I try to do in most of my teaching these days, is to help people to mine traditional sources for contemporary insight and to try and find ways forwards in teaching and practice that are very much focused on now, without at the same time just abandoning all of the ideas in these old texts. Because I think, we have to acknowledge that they don't really address a lot of contemporary concerns, unless we're trying to live like, a yogi from 2,000 years ago, which for the most part meant renouncing. The Bhagavad Gita is one of the very few early texts that talks about combining yoga with worldliness. So what we're doing doesn't have as much of a heritage. And there are elements of tantric traditions that help to try and put some of that into context as well, that there's nothing to turn away from, there's only a fuller embracing of the totality. But, I think we've got some fairly modern, mundane concerns. How do we deal with, the modern types of distractions like, the internet, social media, the telephone in the pocket, the portal to confusion? Sure, you can give it up, but how many of us are actually going to do that? Same with relationships. Traditionally, renounce them, go to the forest, live in a hut. Most of us want to be in relationships. So what does it mean to be in a skillful, yogically informed relationship? No ancient yoga text has any guidance on that, unfortunately. We need to find our own way of, I guess, constructing that. So that's why I try to break things down to sort of elementary principles. And that's how I wrote that book, really, to take the history and philosophy of yoga, distill it into 100 short chapters, which in a way, correspond to building blocks that have been arranged in different ways over the centuries, and invite us to make our own arrangement to a certain extent. because I just don't think there is a one size fits all approach. Or, in really, very simple terms, any possibility of just somehow becoming the embodiment of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, or what's said to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. We can only be inspired by those things to find some modern, analog, something that's connected to it. It's similar, but it's not the same thing. Because Patanjali's message was clear: go to the cave and don't come back. Effectively, sit down and shut up was my brother's attempt to summarize the Yoga Sutra, and I think he's onto something.
Yeah, interesting. And like this kind of actually brings me to a next question that I've had for some time that I'm sure you'll have some great insight in is to when we think about yoga as modern practitioners and start to dive in and explore these teachings, like, I especially think of the 200-hour yoga teacher training now where it's like we read a portion of the Yoga Sutra. It's just a tiny little, I think it's just one or two chapters if you're lucky with your teacher training, maybe a few more. But like you said, it's kind of geared towards the mainstream yoga view. And it's like, then yet still many yoga teachers and practitioners are still a bit confused about the essence of the yoga philosophy and the teachings. And from my background and my experience, I've studied Advaita Vedanta in India with my teacher. And I'm wondering, how can you just bring a little bit of applicable, like understandable information to us who are seeking some clarity in the Sankhya Yoga and the Advaita, like the dualistic view of yoga or the non-dualistic view? Like, how can we kind of just pin those up to see what they are? If that makes sense.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the biggest problem with the way that modern yoga philosophy is presented, it comes down to the focus on postures. Everybody gets taught about eight limbs of yoga. Patanjali's Ashtanga, and the third of those is asana. Patanjali just meant sitting, but the I guess implication that's always there in a modern yoga teacher training is, that's what we're going to teach, basically an asana-focused practice, maybe with a bit of pranayama and a bit of maybe, basic meditation. So asana is a good chunk of the whole project. Try and behave like a good person, do your asana practice, and you're three-eighths of the way there already. And that's the context in which the whole thing is, suggested. But then I was always left as a confused newbie with this unanswered question of, okay, so we get halfway, maybe we get as far as pranayama in that, four out of eight list, a couple of ethical precept categories, do your physical practices, and then what? What happens with this other stuff? How do you get to samadhi? And it was always sort of dangled as this carrot in the distance. Oh, you can't even actually necessarily do these things directly. They are the fruit of what you do. That's the way Iyengar used to talk about it all. Meditation is what people convince themselves they're doing while they go to sleep, sitting in the corner. And actually, if you do this asana with him shouting at you, then you'll definitely be present, and that will be some basic concentration training, and that's the most you can hope for. Maybe in a few decades, other things will happen. But I didn't even get that much explained to me at first. It was just, don't ask too many questions, come to asana class. And I think that's the level on which most yoga philosophy is stuck. And the way that people try to join it all together into something cosmic is to wheel in chakras and say, oh yeah, get yourself lit up like a Christmas tree, and then suddenly, lightning will go off up the top of your head, and awakening will happen. So in some way, somehow, doing stuff with the body is supposed to unblock or cleanse or whatever it is that people like to imagine one's supposed to do with this framework. But that's not the way that traditional texts talk about these things. They're meditation blueprints, the chakra model. The whole function really is part of, an attempt to remake the body through, a re-engagement with what it is, to make it subtler, to subtleize experience. But it doesn't necessarily mean there's a particular thing in a particular place unless you choose to, effectively imagine it into existence. So I guess there's then a lot of confusion because there's all this sort of conceptual baggage. And most of the time, people are just making shapes and feeling, a little bit happier after doing it. And somehow they invent some sort of story about how that all fits together. Whereas, let's come back to the basics of Sankhya Yoga. It's just really coming down to you are not your mind. There is a way of paying attention that enables us to see our own mind, to see the mind doing what it's doing. And there's a part of us that's watching that. And so the two are actually distinct. There is the part that's watching, and then there is this, never-ending noise box that's coming up with all of these stories about me and desire and, attachment and, neediness and anger and discomfort when I don't get all those things I think that I want and need. And all of that is the world of Prakriti. It's, the machinery of form, right down to the subtlest machinery in the mind. And that's not, the ultimate place of witnessing, watching. So from that point of view, there's a sort of separation exercise to step back, to develop the capacity through paying attention at first, just to be with what's happening, and then get subtler and subtler and notice some of the gaps between, mental activity, basically. And then from that place, being able to, see that the mind is a thing that's sort of operating in a field of consciousness, and the stillness of the mind will eventually leave nothing but consciousness reflected back on itself. So that's the dualistic way of getting to a particular place. There is also the non-dualistic way of getting to what is basically the same place, although, I mean, they're completely different paths in a way, because the non-dualistic way is to, step back and see how everything is contained within one thing, and to widen the lens until it's just sort of, impossibly large, unimaginably large, so vast that it does contain everything. It's the field within which everything is happening. But that almost involves not doing anything. It involves watching again everything get quieter, but expanding and expanding. What you might call an open awareness approach to meditation, effectively, I think, is how it functions. But, practically speaking, that's all, not so easy, because it's you get distracted, you start thinking about what's for dinner, you have all of these other things that come up, and so there's all sorts of training around, the philosophy of non-duality, and the Upanishads have these particular, I guess, encapsulations of these basic truths about oneness, and the encouragement is to almost meditate on what it would be to embody that, and to try to bring about the experience of oneness through contemplation of it until it's actually real. So there's all sorts of ways in which that is brought into the picture, but in the end, what's left is just an understanding of a subtler way of perceiving, which is not about the mind and the body. It's just that one contains everything, philosophically speaking, and the other is basically turning away from everything else other than just the pure witnessing. And because of the sort of separation dimension of Sankhya approach to yoga, that's often had a lot to do with a more world-renouncing perspective. I mean, originally Advaita Vedanta was also for world renouncers, because a lot of these transformational approaches to perception were for world renouncers, but it's become, I think, presented much more in terms of, there's nothing to turn away from. It's much more infused actually with the non-duality that comes out of tantric traditions, to be honest, I think, rather than strictly speaking Shankara's approach, because he was still a world renouncer. But yeah, there's a way that some, there's nothing to turn away from. And that instinctively resonates, I think, a lot more with modern yoga students. So to complete the confusing picture that comes out of yoga teacher trainings, you got, yoga's from Patanjali. It's all about the eight limbs that will, connect your chakras in some magic fairy tale way. And the result of that is you'll enter the state of union. Never really clarified what gets united or how a philosophy of union relates to Patanjali, who definitely says that union is the problem that you need to separate your mind from your consciousness to resolve. And then people just get tied in knots and they don't know how to make sense of anything. And so I think it's a lot more helpful just to come back to basics, really, and just to say that the foundation of most early approaches to yoga was meditation. In fact, that was the practice. Meditation could also be enhanced or made more accessible through control of the breath or recitation of mantra. Beyond that, there weren't really many options apart from extreme asceticism, doing really painful things to the body and, ignoring the fact that it hurts. And that will dismantle the machinery of desire quite effectively. But I guess it then just comes back to concentration, the ability to pay attention, to be aware of what's actually happening rather than the stories that we're telling about what's happening. And in the end, it almost doesn't matter which philosophical framework you hang it off. If one is doing some of that, the mind is getting subtler and it can be then, more of an ally in terms of practice instead of the enemy. And there's no need to necessarily, beat the mind into submission, which is sort of how people might sometimes think of, the whole idea of you must still your mind or get it steady. It's just more giving it something to do to concentrate on, Patanjali says, will cultivate the ability to develop that stillness. So regularly finding an object of focus in some way, whether it is the breath, whether it is sound, whether it is, really, it's up to us. The 39th sutra of the first chapter of the Yoga Sutra says, concentrate on anything you like to get rid of your distracted mind. So yes, making shapes, perfectly acceptable thing to concentrate on. But unless it's being presented that way, that the whole point of doing the shape making is to pay attention to a really subtle embodied experience and not be lost in everything else, then it's not really got anything to do with what Patanjali was talking about. So that's the kind of way in which connections can still be made. But the concentration training, I think, is the way in, the ability to pay attention. And that's what we harness, I suppose, in trying to live more skillfully, because paying attention to what our values are and our ability to embody them. And most importantly of all, seeing through our delusion about whether or not we're actually living up to the stories we're telling ourselves, because the world is full of people who claim to be all love and light while acting abominably. And so part of the practice is to actually be, to have a good bullshit detector and, turn it inwards on oneself. And, not to go to war with oneself again, but just to try and, actually be congruent, have an alignment between, intention and expression, and using that concentration training to make that happen. So I think I meandered off in all sorts of directions there. I'm not sure we stuck to Sankhya
No,
versus
it's great.
Advaita, but
But I think it's good because, well, it brought up a lot of questions for me, but it is also a good reminder that these, like you said, frameworks are there, but it's up to the inquirer within to go towards or be on that path to what you had said earlier about your own practice that allows you to sit and quiet your mind in whatever capacity is possible to actually get to the purpose is to quiet the mind, to be with oneself, and then whatever path gets us there, then we stick on that path for however long is required. And I think also when you were speaking, I was thinking about how, for me, like yoga is about getting to that place of freedom from, like you said, the bullshit of my own mind, essentially, but to also approach yoga with the discipline and yet with the freedom. Because if there's too, you also mentioned something about this earlier, like if it's too much discipline and bondage is creating more attachment to this idea of what a yogi is or what a yoga practitioner is, and then that's just sort of more crystallizing the identification with this individual me separate from you or anything else. So it's kind of this fine dance I find of like, sticking on the path, and then suddenly the path becomes so rigid that there has to be a sort of giveway to shift. And I guess, like you said, also flow with the phases of life and the workload and the relationships and approach what is coming in life, in the, as we all have to go through every ups and downs, but how to have the anchor of the practice and yet not be too rigid in the practice.
Not too tight, not too loose, as a friend of
Yeah.
mine who likes to talk about it, he puts it a bit like, I think might have been a metaphor that the Buddha used for how to get an instrument to sound right. But you tighten the strings of your guitar too tight and they're not going to make the right note. You let them get all slack as well. The same thing, same with a drum. So somehow there has to be that, creative tension there. And I think, this is why I'm a fan of dualistic philosophy in some ways. Because everyone's so into the idea of, all things are one and everything's connected, and therefore yoga means union, and we're all the same divine energy or whatever it might be. That all sounds very nice, obviously, and to a certain extent, one can experience that. But the day-to-day reality is there are distinctions. I am having a conversation with you. I don't want to get too attached to the I and the you, but at the same time, if we don't observe that functional distinction, we can't, be in the relationship of this conversation. And so everything is about those distinctions in some ways. And there are all these spectrums on which, things are happening. So the ultimate spectrum from the yoga point of view is, absolute dukkha, suffering at one end, and, release from that at the other end, liberation. And everything operates on these sort of, polarities, but nobody's really at either end, either extreme. We're all somewhere in the middle, and we're having to find a way to cultivate more or less of something. And that's where seeing things in terms of distinctions really helps. And there's often paradox involved in this. Not too tight, not too loose. Pulling in two different directions there, finding this sweet spot. But it's a provisional sweet spot. It's like Ayurvedic medicine. That's a similar way of conducting this experiment on yourself, trying to observe how things are, having a sense of what equilibrium is like and where you might be off center. But it's not straightforward prescription of, this is your point of center, and we can measure it with a machine and just tell you to take X amount of Y substance and Z will be the result. It's a trial and error exercise, and equilibrium shifts. Some days it's here, some days it's there. What's needed will be more this way, that way. It's yeah, so I like the fact that Sankhya philosophy, through the way it talks about the gunas, basically gives us a very simple algorithm. The mind and the body are often dominated by the two gunas that get, sort of less good press in the yoga world, the rajas and tamas. So we're either over agitated or overly dull and lazy or ignorant or heavy or whatever one might, associate with the sort of the darker side of tamas. But without its positive side, without any stability, we'll never sit still and get anywhere in practice. And similarly, Rajas sounds, like you're bouncing around off the walls after 30 Red Bulls, but it's actually the dynamism required to cut through the confusion. So, creative tension between those two is what enables clarity to develop in the mind and the body. And so I often feel that yoga is about trying to sort of work on the mind and the body in terms of its inherent rajas and tamas to try to find some equilibrium. And sometimes it means turning up the agitation, other times it means, turning up the pacification, let's say. And so it's often just thinking about, the whole mind-body system as this enormous, mixing desk in a music studio with all these little sliders and faders, and just trying to make these subtle adjustments. And again, that requires us to be paying attention. And if we're only paying attention on the framework of, is my body in the right shape? Or have I convinced myself that I've unblocked X or Y chakra? Then, it's we haven't got the subtlety of feeling. It's really just at the level of, very basic things. Sort of, for example, how slowly can you lift your arm at exactly the pace that you're inhaling and try and keep it perfectly synchronized? And what's stopping that from happening? And what discomforts are arising? And what could be done to soften everything while still working through that movement? And that's, I mean, it's so basic. It's not really anything to do with asana practice, but it's training awareness. And so I think, anything physical, if it's working that way, it can be a wonderful tool, but it can otherwise just be another way to distract ourselves, make the time go by, and convince ourselves of more self-deluding stories.
That was bringing up my next question. We were talking like, Like, I totally hear exactly what you're saying, and I see it for myself and all the other yoga nerds that I also love to talk to, and how, like, contemplating the gunas is such a perfect way to see how that kind of pacifies my need for equilibrium in the waking state, this existence of just like having this body and trying to feel that sense of equilibrium or that sense of harmony, which is innate within all of us. We all desire that sukh, that sense of freedom or liberation or just feeling easier, like you said in the intro to the book, that peace from in life after life's challenges. But it's like, and then it always brings up, another question of, or is this kind of, like you said, the mind deluding itself? Because ultimately, life is not equilibrium. There is an end point. There, where there is birth, whatever arises will subside. Where there is birth, there will always be death. So I guess it is equal, but yet we are clinging to one end of the spectrum with our fists held so tight. And it's like, is it like how to practice to view as these teachings inspire us and be free and have the awareness of the arm floating and be aware moment to moment and not also just be living in like a self-deluded sort of warped reality of like, peace and love and light.
Well, I mean, again, it's just to come back to what's actually happening. And all the love and light, rainbows and unicorns, self-deluding fantasies that fly around in the modern yoga world, are about often avoiding reality, avoiding the fact that we're still people. We're still subject to decay. We all need to go to the toilet and eat food. Despite these people who like to fantasize about being breatharians or whatever they call themselves, we're all just flesh and blood at some level as well, and that's wonderfully grounding, in my opinion. It helps us, stay humble and to realize that there's no point trying to transcend all of that. And in some ways, the point is to, engage with it fully, to actually be alive to it all. And that doesn't require us to be in any particular way. It's not, our duty to take on all of the world's burdens and somehow try and, appoint ourselves solver of the problems, because that's often just another self-deluding fantasy in itself. But, to at least care about the fact that there's a world out there and that we're part of it, and there is no separation in that sense, because the real truth of death, and there's a wonderful way of talking about it in Indian tradition. There's this idea that we're all made up of five elements. The Sankhya philosophy comes up with these Mahabhutas, the five basic constituent, parts of all things that have form: the earth, water, fire, air, and space. And when you die, you go to the five, is the way it's described in Sanskrit. You've gone back to the five elements. So, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. And out of those five elements, other things will be made. So, in the end, we are just rearranging bits of, organic matter. And, in the grand scheme of things, we don't matter that much. But life is unfolding, and that matters, and we're experiencing it, and that can matter too. And we can find meaning in the way that it matters, even though it might not even have any ultimate meaning other than it's just unfolding. But what we do can give it meaning, and having a purpose, I think, is very important. And that's something that we can create through the way we relate to what's unfolding through us. So I guess, yeah, it's very tempting sometimes to think about blissing out and, just need to stay in the zone and just, basically get high. Or is it possible to just let go of the need for that even and just be with all of it, with all of its messy complication and misery-inducing frustratingness? That's, I think for me, the bigger question now. I used to think, if I did all these practices and just got disciplined enough and moved to a quiet place in the countryside where I currently live, somehow I was just going to get there. I didn't know where there was, but I thought I was close. And honestly, I think I've just got a bit isolated and have come to realize as I get older, actually, Probably don't want to be quite that isolated as much. So I've spent much more time in London in recent years than I used to. And enjoy, being able to come and go from the busyness and the craziness. But I mean, really, the point is to come back to, I suppose in a way, the creative tension that Patanjali puts together in the Yoga Sutra. If we really want to align asana practice and everything else that's going on in the yoga world with what Patanjali's saying, he's talking about a balance between abhyasa and vairagya. And that is the nature of what brings the steady mind. And abhyasa is the repeated effort that cultivates one-pointedness, basically, the steadiness and focus. And vairagya is the absence of craving and clinging. And so it's letting go. And so if all we're doing is practicing, we just get more and more attached to practice. The challenge is to be almost renouncing the thing that we're finding helpful and to be able to let go of it. And I think for me, one of the great gifts I've had in recent years is to find that the things I was quite attached to as a practitioner are no longer happening for me. And to try and see how letting go of my attachment to that is just part of the same project that would have to be engaged with even if I was doing them. And that actually not having the opportunity to do them has forced me to develop a more healthy releasing tendency than I might otherwise have had. Because I think I had a little bit of yoga junkie approach to my practice, and if I hadn't done it or something got in the way of it, out of my way, please. I need my yoga. And so yeah, it's been a very interesting process from that point of view. But vairagya, or as the Gita puts it, tyaga, that's another great word for it, and that's sort of slightly different flavor. It's just releasing. Just letting things pass through, and we've got to let go of this body. So the more practice we get at letting go and allowing things to happen, the more skillful we'll get. But obviously, that doesn't mean we just let everything happen and have no personal boundaries and tolerate abuse or stand by while terrible things are done in front of our faces. No, but the more attached we are to things being a particular way, the harder it's going to be to let go enough to roll with the punches on the ropes, to use a boxing metaphor, and not be knocked down. Instead, to still be there standing. Okay. Stuff's got real. What am I going to do? And yeah, that's life, as far as I see it. So I find myself increasingly seeing everything I'm doing as yoga practice, and how much clarity can I bring to it, based on what else I've been doing. To get myself a bit better equipped for the day-to-day business of, going about life. So yeah, what I might have previously thought of as yoga practice is much smaller part of my day-to-day picture, but it feels like it's started to permeate things a little more seamlessly now. It's not so disconnected. Whereas when I first went to teachers 20 years ago and said, "How does this sequence of postures relate to what's in the Yoga Sutra," and they couldn't give me an answer. It just seemed like they were two completely different things. Philosophy and practice were completely unrelated. Whereas I almost feel like if there was more attention paid to actually talking about ideas in the modern yoga world, we might find it much easier to see that there is no separation. The ideas are just thinking about how to live. And I suppose this one last thing, bringing it back to this question of what is yoga. Yoga was originally a state of being. It is the state in which, the clarity is present and there is no distraction. That's how it's described in the Kathu Upanishad. When, all of the senses in the mind are reined in, so there are no more distractions, that is yoga. It's the highest state. That's what it says. And so if we think of all these other things that you were listing from that little quote, as being ways to use skillful means to access this state of yoga, then yoga isn't the practice. And it's about trying to do things that awaken a state. And so you could have asana yoga, in which the approach to asana has to be cultivating some of that flavor. But if it isn't, then it doesn't deserve the name yoga. It's just, spiritualized stretching. And it's sort of thinking about yoga slightly differently, I think, could be really helpful and actually very empowering and the bar can still be quite low. It doesn't have to be, Samadhi is a long way away, somewhere over the rainbow. It's something we're all familiar with. It's just we don't spend that much time there, that's all. And cultivating a way of, getting a little bit more familiar with it isn't that hard, actually. It's not necessarily also that easy to spend all day there, but that's another question.
Beautiful. Well, I think that's a beautiful place to wrap it up. I really, really have appreciated this conversation. So many more questions come up, but I think it's good to be left with more questions, like we said at the beginning, to just have things to contemplate within our own privacy of our practice, and that happens within. And also why I feel it is so important to have these dialogues with our fellow practitioners and ones who are seeking, whether you call oneself a yogi or not, like you said, man's search for meaning, that one who inquires really, how it really helps, illuminate the self-discovery for ourselves. So I totally feel that we hit the point there today, Daniel. So thank you so much. And I'd love to just finish the conversations with three quick questions, kind of
Sure.
cliche, but I think it just is a nice little touch. So firstly, if you could describe your personal practice in three words.
Softening, settling. The third one is trickier. It's good. I would say releasing, releasing.
Softening, settling, releasing. Beautiful. And a book or a scripture that's currently inspiring your practice or your life.
The Mahabharata, I can't get away from it. I've become obsessed with it. It's like the best soap opera ever, combined with The Wire, which was one of my favorite TV dramas. It's just sort of this constant sort of mingling of who's the good guys, who's the bad guys, what's the right thing to do, how to make sense of anything. And it's enormous. And, I've not read the whole thing in Sanskrit. So I've got many lifetimes of projects that I could embed in that worldview, I think. So, yeah, that's my top tip.
Wow, yeah, that's a big one. That's like the biggest one. Well, and finally, if you could sum this conversation up in one sentence.
Ooh. A generous invitation to open to simplicity, despite my tendency to overcomplicate.
No, it's been great. I really feel though you actually have a skill for explaining things in a way that's, for me anyways, I get it. Even if it leaves me questioning more, it hits. And for me, the kind of intellect that I have, I kind of need that. So I've so have appreciated the book. It's really great. I'm gonna put
Oh.
the link in the notes for everybody that's listening, who they're all yogi, curious yogis, to really get a copy of the book. It is such an amazing resource to have for all these vast, complicated ideas put together in a way that's like relatable, readable, highlightable, if that's a word, So I really, really appreciate that. I know you also have a year-long training program that you do. And just for those that are listening, they want to study with you, they want to learn more with you. I know you have lots going on, but if you just want to share with the listeners what where they can jump in and what to.
Thank you. I mean, the book is called The Truth of Yoga, and there is a website, truthofyoga.com, where I host a variety of online courses. There are some free ones if you want to just get a flavor of who I am and what I say, although I guess if you've made it this far, you've already had a bit of a taste. There are also courses on all of the main yoga texts, which are self-contained, self-study programs, really. There's even a course that accompanies the book and unpacks its ideas. And every now and again, I run those live with discussions as part of the program. But you can always book a one-to-one Q&A session with me if you were to take one of those sort of more limited programs there. Originally, they were 4 weeks that I ran them when they were live, but you can study at your own pace and take as long as you like. But If you're really looking for a deeper dive, there's a project that I started this year called The Path of Knowledge, which runs for a year and basically takes what I've taught in a university setting about the history and philosophy of yoga, kind of rips up the university side of it and tries to present it in an accessible way to curious practitioners, teachers, armchair enthusiasts, with the simple purpose of trying to say, how does any of this stuff from the past relate to us here and now? What are we going to do with it? With a view to inspiring people to, find their own way with philosophy, basically, and perhaps put together some kind of a project, whether that's something they want to teach, something that they want to write, something that they want to produce in some other medium, using the structure of looking through the evolution of yogic traditions as a sort of framework for doing that. And I'll be doing that again from September. And so if you go to truthofyoga.com, there is on the homepage a link to the page where you can sign up for news about when enrollments open. And there's a breakdown of what's on offer. But basically, we cover everything and use it as an opportunity to meet as a sangha every couple of weeks for a live seminar, effectively, but it's much more like a group conversation in which, we split into smaller groups, get to know each other, have structured discussions exploring how to make sense of things, and then feed that back to the larger group and see what bubbles up. So I'm learning a lot through, hosting a conversation with other people who've got, a lot to share. So it's a community, really, other than just sort of me giving lectures. Although there's some of that in there, I record material to bring stuff to life, share some readings, and stir the pot, so to speak, and hopefully something bubbles up out for everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed what you heard, please consider supporting the show at patreon.com/acuriousyogipodcast. And please leave a review. It really helps the show reach more people. Let's stay curious, connected, and keep walking the path together. In total delight, this is Bobby signing off until next time.